It's Wednesday, November 3, 2010. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. The 2010 midterm elections are now behind us, or at least the voting is behind us. The votes are still being counted. Some races are still too close to call. And as the morning is about to dawn, the reality is that we just do not know everything about this election. We do know the big picture. The big picture is a massive, seismic political change, the kind of political reversal that is almost unprecedented in modern political history. On a smaller scale, such things have happened in midterm elections. Almost always, they are a referendum of sorts on the party in power, especially the party in the White House. But in 2010, the tables have turned in a way that is more dramatic and perhaps even more profound than in any other recent political season. This is the third election in a row, the third national election, when, as one witness pointed out, the White House has to be disappointed. There's been a change in the White House, but not a change in that pattern. We're in a strange political season in the United States, a season in which there is yet no fixed political philosophy for the American people. Americans have shown themselves to be basically a center-right electorate. But when it comes to electing officials, when it comes to electing presidents, congressmen, senators, governors, and all the rest, when it comes to supporting this or that policy, well, Americans have not yet developed a comprehensive or coherent philosophy of government. Perhaps Americans never will. Perhaps that's too much to expect of a population. But it is not too much to expect of a government, of a Congress. And that is the challenge that will be faced by those who will be taking office and assuming leadership in coming weeks and months. It's not too early to begin to ask the question what these things mean. While we're scratching our heads and the dust is settling, that's where we really have to turn in order to gain some good understanding of our times and the challenges we are about to face. Several issues, I think, now frame the reality before us. First, we must remember that elections are about ideas. A seismic election like this one is especially about ideas. In this case, an unmistakable message was directed to President Barack Obama. There was a massive judgment on his policies and leadership. His ideological liberalism is not shared by a majority of America's voters. His association with the values of the intellectual elites and his commitment to an expanding role of government distance him from the electorate. Americans will now watch to see if their president got the message. Second, it will take some time to discover how this new Congress will function. There is no shared philosophy of government yet to be detected, only a few shared principles and impressions. There is a vast distance between running for office and holding office. Campaigning and governing require different skill sets and different commitments. There will be a lot of reality therapy in coming weeks. Third, Americans will soon learn the difference between conservatism and libertarianism. A good many of the new faces in Washington will have been supported by the Tea Party movement, and a good number of those are committed to the worldview and political philosophy of libertarianism. Many conservatives are as yet unable to tell the difference. They are likely to learn fast. Fourth, the relative absence of hot-button social issues from the election debate will not last. The issue of same-sex marriage will inevitably be nationalized within the next 2 years, in the courts, if not in Congress. The issue of abortion will not go away, nor will human embryonic stem cell research and a host of other controversies. Even as these issues are reshaped by new developments, you can count on them coming back to the forefront. Fifth, the demographics of this election will tell a number of interesting stories. In my mind, the most interesting of these is the withdrawal of the youth vote, or at least its relative withdrawal. The youth vote was so crucial to the momentum behind the Obama campaign in the year 2008. Statistics available late on election night indicate that the fall-off on the youth vote may be as high as half. That is, there may have been a fall-off of at least 50% in the youth vote. Are younger Americans interested only in electing presidents? Sixth, a political shift of this magnitude brings a multitude of personal consequences. One of the limitations of the democratic process is that it offers very few opportunities to lose an office or a campaign without losing heart. Among those who lost their seats last night were many who had served for years. They, along with staff, must now pack up their belongings, close out their business, and make way for the new. Even those who worked for their defeat must understand the political trauma. Good men and women put their lives on hold and ran in races that many of them lost. Last night, many of them had to make the call they dreaded to make, and then deliver the speech no one wants to deliver. This, too, deserves our notice. Evangelical Christians have moved through several distinct phases of political engagement in recent decades. Coming out of the wilderness years of relative withdrawal from interest in politics, evangelicals then joined the religious right with eagerness and great expectations. But even as some important legislative and bureaucratic victories were won, the religious right never fulfilled its many promises. Now, a good many evangelicals, young and old, are rethinking the political equation once again. Evangelicals tend to swing between extremes when it comes to politics and elections. We are too easily elated and too readily depressed. Make no mistake, the election results of 2010 will lead to big changes in Washington and far beyond. That in itself is good news, but all this must be put into a truly Christian context. Christians are supposed to be the people who know the dangers of investing either too much confidence in the political system or too little. The election is over. Now is the time for Christians to pray for those who were elected and for the government they will serve. Things are going to get interesting very, very fast. Now, beyond the election, there are some other interesting stories. One of them has to do with President Jimmy Carter. The former president was in Salt Lake City on a promotional visit for his book when he made some comments related to the fact that, in his view, religion and politics have become just too close. Kristen Moulton, writing for the Salt Lake Tribune, says, "For a man who evangelized foreign leaders and taught Sunday school while U.S. president, Jimmy Carter has some strong words of what he sees as an, quote, excessive melding of religion and politics," end quote. He went on to criticize the Southern Baptist Convention, saying that this melding, excessive melding, began there. He says, quote, "It's now metastasized to other religions, where an actual affiliation between the denomination and the more conservative elements of the Republican Party is almost official." Mr. Carter said this during a phone interview while he was in Salt Lake City. Now, what's really interesting is that the man who's making this statement is, of course, Jimmy Carter. And as this reporter indicates, this is the very same Jimmy Carter who wore his religion so publicly, who indeed did, exactly as she say here, attempt to evangelize foreign leaders, and he continued to teach Sunday school while he was, indeed, president of the United States. He is a man who, after all, almost single-handedly sparked the discovery of evangelicals on the part of many in the secular media when he ran for president in 1976. But it's also interesting to note that President Carter seems to be very selective in his criticism here. Back when he was running for president in 1976, he openly courted the evangelical vote, and the evangelical vote in his support was at that time invested with a great deal of hope. Many of the kinds of things he complains about here were exactly what he and his campaign encouraged back in 1976. But the reality is that evangelicals changed their minds about Jimmy Carter between 1976 and 1980. The demographics are clear, and the voting statistics tell the story. Evangelicals abandoned the Carter White House and Jimmy Carter's candidacy between the time that he was inaugurated and when he ran for re-election. There were several reasons for this, including Mr. Carter's opposition to legislation that would curb abortions, and, of course, the infamous White House Conference on Families, the title of which indicated that the White House was unwilling, even then in the late 1970s, to draw any conclusive definition or normative understanding of the family. In his new book, his diaries, known as the White House Diary, Mr. Carter has a very interesting statement. The statement is dated in his entry from January the 22nd of 1980. It reads like this: "I had breakfast with evangelical leaders. They're really right-wing. Against ERA, for requiring prayer in school, against abortion, so am I, want publicly committed evangelicals in my cabinet, against the White House Conference on Families. In spite of all these negative opinions, they are basically supportive of what I'm trying to do," end quote. Well, I guess that redefines what it means to be basically supportive. Back to the election for a moment. California's Proposition 19, the measure that would have legalized the possession and sale of 1 ounce or less of marijuana, appears to be headed for a certain defeat. The voting data available early on Wednesday morning indicates that the support for Proposition 19 came from basically two very distinct demographic units in California. The first was younger voters. That's interesting. It tells us something about how younger Americans are tending towards the legalization of marijuana, if not of other drug substances. The second demographic was geographical. The Bay Area, San Francisco in particular, leaned heavily in support of Proposition 19. It'll be interesting to see if this issue does come back again. The proponents of Proposition 19 say that even though their effort failed, they started a debate that is certain to continue. There's reason to believe that their confidence is not misplaced. The effort to legalize marijuana is only the spearhead of a larger effort to legalize many narcotics and other substances. The arguments now coming in favor of legalization have to do with everything from states who want to tax the sale of such things in order to increase their revenue, to those in law enforcement who are warning that the chemists and engineers are staying ahead of the entire law enforcement process by inventing new designer drugs. And then there is the libertarian argument that was popular with many who were in the Tea Party and supporting Tea Party candidates. It will be interesting to see where this particular issue heads. It is not, at this point, a heavily partisan issue, and that's an interesting thing to note. Of all the inflammatory issues in the culture war, of all the issues in which there is a very clear partisan divide, on the issue of the legalization of marijuana, at this point, it is really not a partisan issue. Speaking of partisan issues, it is good for Christians to be reminded that political parties are, after all, political organizations. They exist to elect candidates and then to perpetuate their own interests and power. Christians need to keep in mind always that we live in a fallen world, and human sinfulness infects everything we do and everything we do together. The aggregation of political interests just comes to exaggerate and concentrate sinful propensities. That's why there is no Christian political party, even though Christians must vote according to their dictates of conscience, and there will be a partisan dimension to this. The reality is that we have to expect political parties to act just like political parties. Now, in this last election cycle, something interesting happened. The pressure in the Republican Party was not from its center, it was from its right. And so the Republican Party, as it enters into this next Congress, is likely to be considerably more conservative than it was, even in recent years. In a mirror image, the Democratic Party is likely to be a good deal more liberal. This is because one of the most endangered candidate species of this last election cycle was the conservative, often called Blue Dog Democrat. The deep partisan divide that now appears amongst the American people is going to require Christians, along with other citizens, to think very hard about how we're going to relate to each other and conduct a very ordered and respectful political discourse, even when it leads to political argument. We generally do not have to invest much forethought in how we're going to talk about the things upon which we are agreed. But Christians need to take the lead in working with fellow citizens in thinking through how we can talk about our greatest differences and still remain respectful and clear and Christian. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmoeller.com. You'll find a good many of the thoughts articulated in The Briefing today in my commentary published at albertmoeller.com, which is simultaneously to be published at the On Faith column of The Washington Post. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Moeller. For more information about the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For more information about Boyce College, go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.